Hi everyone, and welcome to this talk called Really Crazy Container Troubleshooting Stories. My name is Gianluca. I'm a core developer of the open source system troubleshooting tool. And today I want to share with you a couple of container troubleshooting stories that all happened to me over the past year or so. And they all revolve around performance monitoring and stability of containers. As you'll see, I'm going to use many observability tools for troubleshooting. So hopefully this will add some value to, to your tool belt of tools that you use daily. And these stories might be a little bit controversial, but I cherry pick them, especially for this occasion, because they will remind us that user space and low-level system components are very, very, very important, even if in the container ecosystem we keep building abstractions on top of what we already have. The first story I have is called Container Isolation Gone Wrong, and it's a story that is meant to show you a little bit what is the real cost and disadvantages of lightweight virtualization, which is the one that is used by containers, obviously. And so I want to start, I'll go rather quick over here because we lost already 5 minutes, but I want to start with essentially the good parts of isolation. As you all know, if you run two containers, by default, each container is wrapped into its own PID, mount, network, namespaces, and things like that. So there's a pretty good level of isolation by default. And then you can also leverage, the various parameters of the C group. For example, if you use the CP accounting C group over here, you can essentially specify the maximum amount of CPU that one container can consume, so that then if you run two containers that try to stress the CPU, one will not be able to use more than 10% of the CPU, right? This is pretty simple. And at the same time, you can also do it from the memory point of view. So if you leverage the memory C group, you are able to make a container not consume more than X amount of memory. And you can see over here in the chart that if I try to do linear memory allocation inside the container, once it reaches the 512 megabyte, which is the same parameter that I use for the C group, the process inside the container essentially gets killed. And this is all well, so this stuff is widely supported by the kernel, is incredibly stable, and is really used as a basic building block for every container runtime. Although, a while ago, something happened. We had essentially a customer, let's call it that way, a sysdig, who came to us and says, we are using Kubernetes to orchestrate a heavily containerized application, and we have different sort of containers all running inside the cluster. And when Kubernetes decide pseudo-randomly to allocate the same two containers on the same machine, so two different kind of containers on the same machine, the performance will suffer. So the performance of these two applications will suffer. So we said, well, the first thing is, are you actually limiting the resources that this container can consume? And this customer said, yes, we are limiting them by limiting using the CPU limits, memory limits, actually even block I/O limits, I believe. So this problem was, at the beginning, quite interesting. And so we started to say, OK, what these two applications do? What are these two applications that are containerized do? And we started studying their behavior. And the two applications that I have are these ones. One is called Worker, and one is called Thrasher. The Worker is essentially a simple watchdog application that doesn't do anything more than every few seconds scanning a directory for files and reacting if the metadata of this file changes. So very simple. And it also reports the duration of this watchdog check as a statistic metric, so that we can inspect it and centralize it and alert on it. And then I have another container, which is called the Thrasher application. And this one does a little bit of different things, but for the most part, it does some asynchronous processing of files. So very, very simple. And so again, the problem is, if these two containers get scheduled on the same host by Kubernetes, even if they are completely resource constrained, the performance will suffer. So the first thing to do is, what do we mean when we say that the performance actually suffers? So to get a higher level understanding of the problem, we can just chart the metric that the worker exports, which essentially measures the duration of the watchdog loop. And you can see it charted over here. And you can see how the pattern is very, very predictable. The watchdog always takes 250 milliseconds to execute. Very, very, very predictable with extremely low variance. And this is when the worker runs by itself on one host. When Kubernetes decides randomly to schedule the other container on the same host, I get this behavior. So the performance of the worker application linearly decreases up until they reach 600 milliseconds per loop. So this is more than 2x the performance overhead. And notice how the performance hit is exactly correlated with the life cycle of the Thrasher container, because these lines over here signals when the Thrasher container is started, and these lines over here signals when the Thrasher container is stopped. So you can see that the second I stop the other container, everything goes back to normal. I go back to the very predictable 250 milliseconds. So this was a quite interesting story, and at this point, you know, it was time to do a little bit more of troubleshooting. And what I like to do is, well, I like to get a little bit of an X-ray of my applications running when I have to do some a little bit more advanced troubleshooting. So I like to use the system call interface. And this was, I'm going to go over this, but essentially this just shows that this container was actually consuming very little resources from CPU, memory, and I/O point of view. I don't have, unfortunately, time to focus too much on this. So at the system call level, I am able to get a pretty good idea of what our process in Linux is doing, even without knowing how to read its source code, or even if I don't have its source code, right? And this is a quote that I really like from the S-Traceman page that says that in some cases, the S-Trace output has proven to be more readable than the source. And this resonates really, really well with my experience. So I'm going to start by getting a system call analysis of my two applications. And I could use S-Trace for this troubleshooting. I'm actually going to use Sysdig because I'm a core developer of it, and it's a little bit more container friendly. But for the most part, any system call sniffer will do. So I'm going to start, in this case, by using my system call sniffer, specifying as a filter container name equal worker. And this is a pretty good snippet of the activity of the container. So you can see, as I said, worker is a watchdog process that opens a bunch of directory. So you can see that the worker starts by opening a directory, in this case, /linux/.git, so a Git repository. And it gets back a file descriptor, which is essentially the file descriptor of the directory. And then it uses this file descriptor of the directory to another system call, the getDents, so the getDirectory entries, that will return the list of children of this directory. So all the subfiles and subdirectory at the immediate next level. And for each element returned by the getDirectory entries, the worker process will use the lstatsystem call for each child to get metadata information from the inode. So it will get file type, file size, a bunch of timestamps and things like that that it will use for its processing. And in fact, you can see that it does the lstat on head, and then it does the lstat on branches. When the worker recognizes that the actual child, the actual directory entries, is a directory itself, it just recurs. In fact, you can see over here that then it uses immediately the openat /linux/.git/branches. And this is just a typical, you know, full depth scan of a directory that you will do in any sort of programming language or scripting. And then when it finishes, it prints on screen the number of files processed, 61,000, and their total size. And again, it's not doing anything, it's just reading statistics via the lstat system call. And you can see by comparing latencies, which is something you can do quite well from the system call point of view, that there's 250 milliseconds of difference between these two numbers, which exactly matches, you know, the watchdog loop duration. What about the Thrasher container? The Thrasher container does a little bit of a similar activity, except that it opens a bunch of random files. Look at over here. All the files that is open are /tmp, /this random UUID. And it does this a few times per second, although if you can see over here, none of these openat actually succeed. All these openat will return an error enoent, you know, which is the kernel that says this file doesn't exist. And it does this for, again, a few times per second. Then you can see that there is actually a context switch, a process context switch, and the process then sleeps for about a second and a half, if you compare the two timestamps, and then it tries again with a new set of random files. Again, this logic is a little bit stupid. The original application was doing something more interesting. But for the purpose of this, it's fine. This behavior is enough to actually reproduce the whole performance issue. So now that I have the system call analysis, what I can do is I can start to dig more into the question, what part of my process is slowing down when these two containers are scheduled, right? It could be either user space, in which case I don't see any any essentially system call latency increase, or it could be from the system level, so from the kernel level. And so if I take a view of my system call analysis before the performance issue and during the performance issue, and I compare all these numbers, then I am able to essentially see if this latency is centered around a specific set of system calls. So I could do this by hand. One of the reasons why I use Sysdig is because I can script this analysis actually with simple Lua scripts. And so I'm exactly going to do that. And here I have the result of two scripts running that will output me on screen where the delay is spent when the thrasher is not there and when the thrasher is there. Now, if you compare these two, you can see that all these numbers look all quite similar, except the LSTAT system call. You can see how the LSTAT system call, when the performance issue is there, takes 3 seconds more to execute. And if I compare these 3 seconds more to the actual duration of the system call analysis that I did, I get exactly those 300 milliseconds overhead that were over there in the chart. So clearly, the worker process is slowing down because the LSTAT system call itself is much slower. So this was interesting. There is also one more thing that I can essentially troubleshoot, which is this additional 3 seconds delay caused by one specific directory access? For example, is this focused on one specific LSTAT invocation, or is it evenly spread across all the 61,000 LSTAT system calls that the worker process does? And to do this, I'm going to use another essentially tool in the troubleshooting world, which is essentially the spectrogram. So if I take all these latencies and I chart them by frequency, I can get to something like this, where I can see the frequency of my system calls bucketed by their delay. So each row in this chart is 1 second of activity of my process of my watchdog worker. So you can see it's pretty impulsive, right? It's you know, it does something, then it goes to sleep for a few seconds. And the red bands show us where the latency is focused at. So you can see that during the whole duration, the vast majority of the LSTAT system calls were under 1 microsecond. What if I compare this with the second case when the performance issues are there? I get a very similar view, although notice how this time all the LSTAT system calls are much more skewed towards the 10 microseconds. So look at here the difference, 1 microsecond, 10 microseconds, almost. So we have almost a 10x overhead evenly spread across all the LSTAT system calls. Very good. At this point, I kind of exhausted what information I can gather from a system call analysis. Because again, the next question is, why are the LSTAT system calls low, right? Which part of the LSTAT system call is causing this issue? So I'm gonna switch troubleshooting tool, and this time I'm gonna get into perf. I'm sure most of you know perf, but perf is essentially the official kernel observability tool shipped with the Linux kernel itself. And it's by far the tool with the highest number of arrows into each kernel subsystem. Because you can do a lot of very cool things. You can do performance counter, dynamic tracing, dynamic probing, almost essentially live debugging. You can do CPU profiling. So in this instance, I'm going to use perf for doing actual CPU profiling. So I'm going to profile the activity of the worker process while the overhead is happening. And this will show me all the functions executed in the kernel space on behalf of my process. And so this is how I invoke it. I invoke it with perf top, bypassing it the PID of the process in the global PID namespace. And this will show me all the functions. And you can see the overwhelming majority of the kernel time on behalf of the worker process is spent on the dlookup function. So the LSTAT system call is calling this dlookup function. Now, what the hell is the dlookup function? I can use perf once again. If you give perf enough debugging symbol, it will give you a lot of information. So if you use actually perf probe on the dlookup symbol, it will actually print you the kernel function. And this kernel function is quite simple, but I want to go over with you what it does. So the LSTAT system call, every time you need to open a path, it calls the LSTAT system call. What happens in Linux is that if you have a generic path like /tmp/foo, there's a bunch of crap that the kernel needs to do in order to ensure that this path is valid. So it needs to start, by the /inode, navigate the inode on disk, enrich the directory entries which are pointed by the inode and match each one until one named TMP is found. Then from the TMP, repeat it again with the TMP inode and go until you find one that is named foo. This is a lot, you know, of disk accesses and stuff like that. So it makes a lot of sense to cache this information. And in fact, the dlookup function is exactly a function that taken the directory entry of a parent and taken a string name of a child, it will look up in the directory entry cache if this path has already been before. And the directory entry cache itself is implemented just as a very big hash table, so classic hash table, you know, with an array, essentially bucketizing items, and then a list of all the directory entries hashed into the same value. So why the worker process is slow during actually a cache lookup? Could it be that since this is a hash table, this hash table is growing a lot and it's causing some sort of issues? So it, for example, increases the number, you know, of hash table collisions, and this causes a performance as seen in user space. I can verify this with another troubleshooting tool, and I can use Slaptop. Slaptop is a very simple tool that prints me the size of the kernel caches, so all the object pools are located in the kernel caches. And you can see that when the thresher is running, the D entry cache, the directory entry cache, is 20 gigabytes in size with 102 million with 102 million directory entries, which is far bigger than all the files that I actually have on disk, you know, on this file system. I've never operated on a system with 100 million files. And if I use it without thresher, instead, when the performance issue is not there, when the other container is not there, the entry cache is just 14 megabytes. So these 20 gigabytes are the ones that are causing the hash table average lookup because of collisions to become slower. So how the hell is it possible that my thresher container is affecting so much this hash table? And the reason is over here. In this first analysis, you can see that the thresher process tries to open a bunch of files that don't exist. But since the kernel is very smart, it does some sort of negative caching. So even if a file doesn't exist, it saves into its d-entry cache the information that it didn't exist. So that next time I ask for it, it will say, no, I don't have it, without doing any sort of disk accesses. Unfortunately, in this case, since the d-entry cache is a singleton, because it's not virtualized, since it's a singleton, the thresher process is able to pollute it, and as a byproduct of this, the worker container suffers because the worker container needs to access the d-entry cache, and so it will cause a bunch of issues. So two very important things. Using all this memory for the d-entry cache is very good because this is idle memory. This is memory that has not been reclaimed by any user space process, so the kernel is putting it to good use. And issue number two, this is not an I/O contention issue because these processes are just doing a few kilobytes of I/O per second. You know, trying to read some I/O doesn't really cost anything. So this is a data structure contention caused by the fact that the d-entry cache is a singleton between all the containers in my system. Now, to go to the conclusion is a little bit controversial, but it turns out that this customer was using a distribution based on EL6, so a very old kernel with containers, which again, the people in this audience will laugh about it, but I mean, this really happened, so that's why I brought this story, because this really happened, and it was like a very big customer or something like that. And it turns out that, of course, the EL6 kernel is not the best target platform for containers. And in fact, even if a process is limited in a memory group in a container, on an EL6 kernel, on a 2.6.32, it can still cause enough kernel allocations on kernel caches that far exceed the actual limit of the memory cgroup set. This behavior was fixed a while ago. So if you use a modern kernel, this doesn't happen. The thresher container, if was memory limited, wouldn't have been able to allocate 20 gigabytes of the entry cache object. But this still proves a point. You know, the point that I was going to make is that on a recent kernel, this issue will not happen. But since not every resource is virtualized, there will always be maybe a global per subsystem kernel lock or a singleton data structure that could cause actual contentions between containers. And it has to be, because if every single resource was actually isolated, we wouldn't have lightweight virtualization, and we would have another KVM, right, for containers. So the gist of it is that you should probably and properly observe your application so that you know what performance you want to expect and things like that. Because Kubernetes is never going to be able, you know, to, in a scheduling decision, to determine, oh, there's this one has too much memory allocated in a kernel cache, so I'm going to be much smarter in my scheduling decision. So this is something that, as an operator, you have to handle. This was the first story. The second one is a little bit shorter, and I'm going to cut it quite heavily because time is running out. And it's called In Search of FFFFF600400. This was a typical Heisenbug that happened to me. So a thing that I could never replicate. And so it started by us shipping an application to a customer in containers. This application was composed of several containers. We had a Java application, then we have a couple databases, like we had MySQL and Redis. And this customer said, OK, I deployed this application on Kubernetes, but your containers are not starting. And he sent me this chart of essentially the metric Kubernetes pod restart count, showing me that the Redis container was constantly restarting. You can see the Kubernetes is restarting with an exponential backoff delay, which means that the container wasn't starting itself. And there were two interesting things in this problem. The first one is that there were no logs at all from Docker, from Kubernetes, from Redis itself. And the second one is that among all the containers that could have failed, the one that failed was Redis, which we used it very little for our application, so we didn't customize it. So we took an off-the-shelf Redis image straight from the Docker Hub. And as you can imagine, this ran very, very well on my machine, right? So again, system call-based analysis. And this is a system call-based analysis of the container that is not starting. You can see that it starts with an execv system call, which is just a system call that you use to, you know, execute a new program in Linux. And the executable is bash as an argument entry point.sh. So this is just a standard container entry point that runs in pretty much every container and sets up a bunch of crap like environment variables and things like that. Although 5 seconds the execv over here from 133 to 138, you can see that the process exited with status 11. So status 11 means that the process crashed, right? In fact, right before, you can see that a signal was delivered from the kernel to the bash process of type signal segmentation fault. So the bash process did a weird memory access that caused it to crash. And right before the signal deliver, you can see a page fault event. So there was indeed an invalid memory access, a page fault event on this address, FFFF600400. So bash tried to access this weird memory address. And what was even weird is that, look at here, the instruction pointer itself was FFFF600400. So not only the memory access was done by bash, but was done as part of an instruction fetch. So the bash process was trying to execute a function at this weird memory address, which is at the very far end of the 64-bit address space. And again, I'm not super advanced in that area, so I was very surprised at the beginning, because again, bash is supposed to be a very stable process, right? I mean, I've never seen it crash usually, so I was very surprised. Okay, so system call analysis done. So at this point, I need to go, you know, to standard developer, let's call it troubleshooting. So we asked the customer for a core dump of this, and I opened it with GDB. And with GDB, I just use, you know, the standard BT to show me the stack trace of the bash process. Because again, it's not ready. It's the bash process at the time of the crash. And you can see that indeed, the lowest stack frame, it's FFFF600400. So indeed, bash was trying to call a function at that memory address. But if you walk up the stack, you can see that time was in the stack trace. And time is a very simple system call that shouldn't do anything other than, you know, return the current timestamp. So why exactly bash decided to call this other weird address instead of just natively sending a system call invocation? And GDB is kind enough to point me to the actual source code where this time invocation is done, right from the libc. So I decided to obviously go and open the can of worms and go look at the time.s file inside the libc source code at that version. And this is a bunch of assembly that shows you how the vsyscall time is called. But what was interesting is that the actual address, FFFF600400, is actually defined at the very top of the file with this name, vsyscall.vtime. So this was enough to give me enough material to go on Google, you know, and research what the hell a vsyscall is. And it turns out that the vsyscall is an optimization relic from the past. So as you know, whenever you have to invoke a system call, there's a protocol, right? So you have to write all the arguments in, you know, in the CPU registers, and then you have to send a special instruction to the CPU so that it switches to kernel mode and the system call is executed on the process behalf. Turns out that this is much slower, right, than a native function invocation where you just have to advance the instruction pointer and fix the stack. So the kernel developer said, okay, there are a few system calls that are very simple, like time, get time of the day, get CPU, and something like that. And it's quite a waste to have them switch to kernel mode just to execute very little and then return. And so the kernel developers, a long time ago, implemented this vsyscall mechanism where they said, okay, we're going to map into every process in Linux, we are going to map the native code for a few system call invocation so that if user space wants, user space can just execute them straight from this address natively without switching to the kernel. And the time system call was indeed hard-coded at this address. And then, of course, you know, the libc adapted. That's why in the libc code you can see this thing. But over time, it turns out that this vsyscall mechanism is quite, it's not very secure because mapping native instructions to a predictable location in every single address space is not the most secure thing. And so kernel developers said, okay, let's crash that and let's actually re-implement this at the VDSO, which is the current state of the art. And for the purpose of this discussion, the VDSO is exactly like the vsyscall, except that the native code is not mapped at a fixed location in the address space, but is randomly mapped, you know, as you would normally do, you know, with a memory mapped file or things like that. So then of course, the libc adapted and said, okay, now we are gonna start using the the VDSO. And it turns out that over time, vsyscall was more and more deprecated to the point where if you use a modern kernel, the vsyscall doesn't really work well, and you enter in one of these two cases. If you try to execute from most Linux distribution nowadays from the vsyscall page, you can still execute it, but you will get trapped into the kernel, and the vsyscall will get emulated for you, so there's really not like native machine code. Or if you use most secure distributions, the vsyscall is actually disabled, and if you try to execute from the vsyscall page, your process will be terminated. And this is not a problem, right? Because if you use a modern distribution, whoever packaged the distribution for you obviously took care of shipping a modern libc, right? But you can already see how this is going. Since I'm using containers, and the libc is not a dependency of the Linux distribution, but the base container image, it turns out that this customer was using a very modern Debian kernel that enabled the vsyscall none around exactly one year ago. And they were kind enough to say, this breaks glibc 2.13 and earlier, which is fine, because again, if you use, you know, this modern Debian kernel, you're going to use this modern libc that comes with Debian. And can you imagine what the libc version was in my Redis container? 2.13. And this is an image straight from the Docker app. This is just a bit older version of Redis, but, you know, quite stable and, you know, battle ready. So just because I was using the Redis container based on an old base image, I got screwed. And of course, in my system, it was working because my system, which is running a slightly older Debian, was still using the emulated vsyscall mode. Now, even if I didn't experience the crash, remember, though, that the emulated vsyscall mode, as I was saying, is an emulation. So I then did a little benchmark, and look at this. If I'm using the time system call from a libc version that uses the VDSO, I can do 260 million events per second, super fast. This is native function call invocation, incredibly fast. Whereas if I use the vsyscall emulated mode, which again causes a trap into the kernel, something like that, I can just do 1 million events per second. So there's a massive difference in throughput. Of course, with Redis, I'm not going to suffer this much overhead, right? Because it's not that my Redis process is just spinning in a loop doing time. But you can get the idea. And again, the idea for this is that I want to just, which might be completely obvious, you know, to this audience, because it's a very advanced technical audience, but user space really needs to be taken care of and needs to be loved on your base distribution as well as on your base images. So even if you download a Docker image straight from the Docker Hub, take care, you know, to just inspect the Docker file. And if you see, you know, that it's based on Debian Wheezy, say, whoa, okay, maybe I need to change it. And that's what happened. And again, this is an issue that really happened to me. And this is all I had. If you later take a look at the slides, I have a little bit of additional more content when I actually use perf in the first exercise to actually measure how many hash collisions were per individual DLOOKUP invocation, as well as I did a few experiments when I was actually looking at how the emulated system call mode works and things like that. So this was quite useful from the point of view, you know, of understanding the system, especially because I'm not an expert in those areas. And I think we are a couple minutes earlier, so if there's a couple questions, I'll be happy to take them. Otherwise, thank you very much. There's a question somewhere. I cannot, where is it? Oh, no. There's a question there. I did not hear anything, unfortunately. How? Which one? How did I fix? This one? This last one? We just essentially recreated the Docker image of the Redis container with a much newer base image. I think we went with Alpine and everything was working fine. Because it was a mistake on our side, you know, to begin with, because we saw this on the Docker. We said, you know, it must be good because it's the official one. It was not one that you just do with, you live and learn. So that's definitely something we learned. Another question, yeah.
You added one slide about the performance of the VDSO against the native.
Yeah.
Do you have an idea why there is such a big difference between the two?
Oh, yeah. So you mean this one, right?
Between the first and the second column.
You're saying why the native one is not doing 266 million.
Yeah, exactly.
That's because the native one is not implemented with native machine instruction itself. But if you look at here, the native one, if you go actually with GDB, and you print the content, you know, with this as you print the content of the VS Code page, you can see that this actually is just a standard system call invocation. There's a move, you know, of the system call number into the AX register, and then there's a system call invocation. Whereas the VDSO, it's really native code right there. So this still calls a trap into the kernel. It's faster than the other one that is emulated, because the other one uses an emulation via page fault, and then the page fault itself has a big switch in the kernel that emulates this. But this is the reason. Cool. Thank you very much again.